Welcome to this course on designing for the post-carbon economy. My name is Enoch Sears, and I'm the publisher of Business of Architecture. This course was originally recorded as part of the Business of Architecture Summit in 2014. This course is registered with AICES for continuing professional education. Credits earned on completion of this course will be reported to AICES for AIA members. Certificates of completion for both AIA members and non-AIA members are available upon request. Designing for the post-carbon economy, it's zero or nothing. Our presenter today is Eric Corey Fried. He's the Vice President of the International Living Future Institute, a global hub for visionary programs, including the Living Building Challenge and Living Product Challenge. As a licensed architect, Eric brings over 20 years of experience in helping architects, builders, and homeowners use sustainability to improve the design and operational savings for thousands of buildings in the country. Eric helps companies monetize sustainability by showing them how to cut their real estate operations costs in half. Eric is considered a leader in the field, named by San Francisco Magazine as the Best Green Architect in 2005. Best Visionary in 2007, and Green Visionary by 7x7 Magazine in 2008. In 2012, he was named one of the 25 best green architecture firms in the U.S. and one of the 10 top most influential green architects. In this course, you'll learn about how the next generation of buildings can't simply continue trying to be less bad or made us feel guilty about our lifestyles. What are needed are living, regenerative buildings that do no harm and repair the damage we've done. So in this course, you will discover how biomimicry can teach us how to transform our built environment. You'll understand new methods to sell these ideas to the entire team. You'll learn how to achieve bio-inspired design, solving some of building industry's most difficult challenges. And you'll also be exposed to some incredibly exciting design solutions modeled on designs found in nature. So with that, I'll turn it over to our presenter, Eric Corey Fried.
I'm going to start by saying thank you for that great introduction. It's always painful to hear your own introduction, but essentially I'm an architect. And all the buildings that I work on are green. We don't have some green buildings and some non-green buildings because, frankly, I wouldn't know what to call them, right? Would those be the toxic buildings? So I just found over the last 22 years it's easier just to kind of force it on everybody. And this idea that we would kind of raise the bar, that we kind of set the bar higher and force everybody to reach for it, is working. It really gives, you know, my job is really to give people a real bold path to things that they thought previously impossible. So I'm usually the guy in the room that's saying, hey, why don't we go for net zero energy? And everybody in the room says, oh, it can't be done. And really, it's my job to show them how to do it. And I think it's the same with you. I think all of us have a responsibility to do this. The trouble is that for most of the environmental movement, we've been apologizing. Gosh, do you think it's okay if we don't put cancer-causing chemicals in the building? Is that all right? Stop it. It's annoying. Don't do that. Don't apologize. We don't need to apologize. You don't need to apologize for doing the right thing. Just force it on them. So much easier. First of all, you'll sleep better at night. You'll digest food better. It'll just be easier. Trust me. Also, if you're under the age of 30 and you tweet, here's my Twitter handle if you want to do that. There's my email address if you want to reach me, of course. And then if you want to use the hashtag, please feel free. As another alternative, you could just live in the moment and pay attention for the next hour. And then we're going to have some great Q&A at the end too. Okay. So I want to start this presentation with a video clip and to kind of set the tone for this morning's talk.
Many dangerous questions. Because with our present knowledge, we have no idea what would happen. Even now, man may be unwittingly changing the world's climate through the waste products of his civilization. Due to our release through factories and automobiles every year of more than 6 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which helps air absorb heat from the sun, our atmosphere seems to be getting warmer.
So this clip, first of all, this clip, it's directed by Frank Capra, who did It's a Wonderful Life, which is just an interesting bit of trivia. And it also stars a very young Dick Cheney, which is weird. That's just weird to me. But the interesting part of this clip is that it's from 1958. everything this man says in the clip is still true to this day. In fact, the numbers are even worse. So what have we been doing since 1958? We knew about this back then, and yet we haven't really done anything to resolve it. We have the same problems, and actually the problems we're facing are even worse. We've used up all of our kind of available time to think about it, and that's kind of the problem. Now, this is my daughter. I know she's cute. You don't need to say anything. But she's six, and I took her to this net zero project that we did, and this project was a little unusual because the solar panels on this project were on the ground. They weren't on the roof. It's a long story, but essentially they were on the ground, which is cool because you could walk up to them and touch them and see them and play them, and for a six-year-old it was fun. And she said, "Daddy, what are these?" And I said, "Oh, honey, those are solar panels. They produce energy from the sun for free." And with the mind of a child, of course, she's just asked the question, "Well, Daddy, why don't all buildings have this, Daddy? Why?" And so I leaned down, and I looked into her cute little face, and I said, "Oh, honey, that's because most people are douchebags." What am I going to tell her? The truth? I can't tell her the truth. That'll mess her up. "Well, you see, honey, there's this giant oil and coal cartel that's conspiring against every..." I mean, that would give her nightmares. I can't tell her that. So douchebags, it's easier, really. I don't have a good answer. That's the real answer. Why? I don't know why. I ask the same question myself, especially in states like California where, essentially we're on par with coal at this point, price-wise. And we're not helping as environmentalists. We're kind of making it worse. And I'll give you an example. Here are three bulbs, and you all know these bulbs. There's the old-fashioned incandescent. There's the CFL, which we all have used and love. And then, of course, there's the latest, greatest LED, and which, of course, is the greenest choice. And most of you would probably be saying, "Well, LED." But the truth is, no, it's incandescent, because that's the one that's off. You see what I'm saying? We're missing the bigger picture. We're so nerdy, and we're so excited to get the right answer that we'll jump, "Oh, LED." But we have to stop being nerdy and realize that the bigger issue is, well, why are we using so much electricity in the first place? And maybe we can step back and really answer the question. Because we're pretty dumb as a species. We think we're smart, which actually makes it worse. But generally, we're all kind of stupid because we're so eager to show that we're right and forget what we were shooting for in the first place. And it kind of works like this.
You know what it says on a box of chocolate pudding mix? Caution. Pudding will get hot when heated. Go to a hotel. You know what it says on the shower cap in the bathroom? It's one head.
You have a shower cap?
I read. And I'm dying to know the suit that prompted lawyers to insist on the shower cap directions. Look at the box your iron came in. It says, "Warning, do not iron clothes while wearing them." We really have to slow down for these people.
And that's what we're doing. We're slowing down for these people. We do it all the time. It's really maddening. And we just stop doing it. Stop asking permission to do the right thing. Just force it on them. Trust me, it's so much better. Because of this, because we are constantly slowing down for dumb people, I really refer to us as a species as dodo sapiens. That's the word I've been using for the last few years to describe what we do. Because how else can you explain it? Our way of life is knowingly killing us, and we talk about this openly, and we joke about it, and yet we don't do really much to change it. And that's just crazy. I realize working with developers, trying to walk them through this process is a lot like being a parent. And if you're not a parent, you might not know this, but and nobody will tell you this. But being a parent is incredibly boring at times. I mean, yes, it's wonderful and loving and full of nurturing things, but it can also be painfully, awfully boring at times too. And sitting with my six-year-old while she's doing Connect the Dots, it's basically the same exact feeling I have sitting with developers, where I'm like, "Come on already, come just hurry up and catch up already," because we're championing these crazy little victories. You know what it's like? It's like managing a baseball team, like a little league team, but for a not very good team. That's kind of what it's like. It's like, ooh, it's just bittersweet. You want them to just be better, and we're championing these silly victories, like, "Oh, you use low VOC paints. Good for you, I guess. That's wonderful. Oh, you use low-flow showerheads. You should do that anyway, but great. Oh, you're going for LEED? Oh, that's LEED Platinum? That's pretty... Oh, not Platinum? You're just going for Basic Gold Certified? Oh, okay, well, I guess that's good, too. I don't know." And we have to be cheerleaders for this and jump up and down for these crazy little victories that aren't victories, that should be, I think, painfully obvious to a lot of people. And people come to me for absolution. They want me to give them, assuage them of their guilt. And I go, "Here you go, Architect Barbie. Here, there, you're, free. You don't need to feel guilty anymore." And it's really just strange that we have to do this little dance all the time to cheer people on for things that we should be doing automatically and we should have been doing for decades. And people ask me these crazy questions. They say, what's my client going to think if I offer sustainability to them? I don't know that you're doing your job. I mean, why are you so afraid of your clients? I mean, that's the kind of the question I have. Who are their clients that they're so afraid of it? It never occurred to me that in the 22 years that I've been doing this, the biggest obstacle to progress wouldn't be our imagination or our creativity, but the biggest obstacle to progress would be other architects who are too afraid to actually speak up to their clients. This, by the way, if you don't know what that is, that's called a T-square, and we used to use those back in the day. Anyway. Building Design and Construction did this survey a year ago at this time, and they interviewed hundreds of architects, and they asked them, you know, when are you offering sustainability solutions to your clients? And a whopping 62% of them said basically only when the client asks for it, you know, if the client leads the discussion or the client asks. So that means two-thirds of all architects are basically just cowering in fear, waiting for their, you know, for their, hoping that their clients can ask about sustainability, and if they do, not really knowing what to say. Pathetic. I mean, they talk about sustainability like it's this dirty word. Sometimes I'll hear them whisper it. You know, they'll say, hey, do you really think we can have solar panels? And it's like, why are you whispering? You don't need to whisper. It's solar panels. Say it out loud. It's a good word. Everybody should be happy to hear it. It's not a dirty word. It's a good thing. Who are your clients that you're this afraid to talk to them and communicate? I mean, these are probably not your clients. I mean, I'm hoping not anyway. Your clients are probably, like mine, your clients are probably, you know, just rich white people. And they're not scary, rich white people. I mean, some of them are very nice, actually. By the way, I have no idea why Shelley Long from Cheers is in this photo. That's just a weird aside. Anyway. By the way, speaking of rich white people, you guys, the recession was hard on them, too. I don't know if you know this, but I had some clients. They couldn't use the North Gate for like 6 months because they had to make some cutbacks. So, you know, it was hard on them. So if you see a rich white person, give them a hug, will you? Because they had a difficult time of it too. Okay. We have to stop letting fear prevent us from moving forward. Fear is not a reason to not do something. Actually, it's quite the opposite. Fear is the reason we should do something. We need to overcome our fear. We need to do something. We need a little courage, actually. You are professionals. You have a duty, a responsibility to offer these things to your clients. If you want to be afraid of something, don't be afraid of your clients. Be afraid of reality, because that's friggin' terrifying. This is 131 years of climate data put into a little chart. And you can see right around World War II, the Earth starts to really heat up. And then right around 1981, we hit a tipping point, a point of no return, which is why the 10 hottest years on record have all occurred in the last decade. Really. So the Earth is getting warmer, and this reality is horrific. And I think of my daughter and her little friends as the last generation. And I don't mean in a morbid way. I just mean as the last generation that can just take nature and energy and fossil fuels for granted. Because we've just expired the clock. We've run out of time. We can't really do much else. And if you think this is some abstract thing that's going off in the distance, all of this is happening now in real time. The numbers keep coming in day after day. Just wave after wave of bad, depressing news. And so this is not a distant thing we have to worry about in the future. It's happening now. Do you realize that every year we have about 400,000 people dying from climate change? And, I mean, this is happening from, you know, various effects of climate change, but drought and food disruption and diarrhea and spread of illness, but direct things that can be tied directly to climate change, things that climate change is worsening. 400,000 people a year, and this is happening all over the world. It's not, you know, it's not just in certain places. It's everywhere, including the U.S., by the way. And I didn't know if 400,000 people is a lot of people, because it seemed like a lot to me, but I didn't, you know, I also know that we lose 3,000 a day to AIDS, right? So maybe it's not a lot, but it turns out 400,000 people is 2.5 times the amount of people we're going to lose to lung cancer this year. It's 10 times the amount of people we're going to lose to breast cancer this year. In fact, 400,000 people is more than we're going to lose to strokes, accidents, Alzheimer's, and diabetes combined here in the U.S. just this year. So it is a lot of people, and yet most people are not only not talking about it, many people just deny it even exists, which is crazy. I mean, that's just nuts to me. I often wonder what rock bottom would look like, how bad the things need to get before we do something. And it seems like this could be it, right? because we've had these warning signs now for 30 years telling us something's happening, big, loud signs yelling at you, screaming at you, right, telling you that something is changing, that we've hit a climate fiscal cliff, we've reached a tipping point, really. And our president goes on the air and tells us that we need to act, and we need to do it now. So I don't know what else we can do, frankly. 2013, last year, was also kind of an interesting year because it was the first year that the cost of dealing with extreme weather, Hurricane Sandy and things like that, the cost of it now surpassed the education budget here in the U.S., right? We spend $2.6 billion on education every year. We spent $3 billion in 2013 on dealing with extreme weather. And as much as that seems like an obscene amount of money, $3 billion, you got to remember that we spent $8 billion subsidizing the oil and coal companies. So maybe it's not that much after all. Maybe it's just a matter of moving the numbers from one column into another. The act of building is disruptive. It is impactful. It is the biggest, most environmental impact on the Earth, right? Every year, the concrete industry produces 3 tons of concrete for every single person on Earth. Every year, the lumber industry cuts down 2 trees for every single person on Earth. And every year, we produce 600 pounds of steel for every single person just in the U.S., And powering all this is not love or kindness or even capitalism. Powering all this is just plain old fossil fuels, and it's an immense amount of energy. Exxon, the most profitable corporation in the history of the world, every day they pump 4 million barrels of oil out of the ground, every single day. And as much as that seems like an absurd amount of energy, it's nothing compared to the 92 million that all the oil companies suck out of the ground every single day. And when you look at it in that way, you realize, well, that just can't continue, right? I mean, that's just not sustainable. It doesn't make any sense. Sheikh Yamani famously said, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones, right? The Oil Age isn't going to end because we run out of oil. It's just going to get harder and harder to get, more and more difficult. And that's what you've been experiencing. That's why some of us are paying $5 a gallon at the pump, right? Because of that. And we've all been waiting for this Hollywood ending, this superhero thing where someone's going to invent this magic spray, and you spray this under your armpits twice a day, and no more climate change, right? And that would be great, but it's not likely. It's probably not going to happen. It does in the movies, but not in real life, right? There's also these other effects, these kind of annoying effects of climate change that you're also feeling now that you might not be aware of. And some of them are kind of goofy, so I wanted to share them with you. Airplane turbulence is now 10% more bumpy because of climate change. So if you're on a flight in the near future, you might notice that. But even other things, bigger things, capitalist behemoths like McDonald's, even those have now been affected by climate change. And here's how it works.
This is the threat town. McDonald's dollar menu. With just the change I find between my couch cushions, I can eat something with the nutritional value of a couch cushion. That's why this McNugget of McNews supersized my anger and made me grimace. Filet of fish. Jim?
America's favorite fast food joint says goodbye to its dollar menu.
Yes, the dollar menu and more, or what other restaurants call the menu. And it's all due to climate change. Looky why. Rising temperatures have led to drought conditions in cattle ranching states, forcing ranchers to cull herds and pay more for feed, leading to more expensive cattle on the market. Well, if cattle feed has become so expensive, why don't they just feed those cows stuff off the dollar menu? Do I have to think of everything?
So even something like McDonald's, as American as McDonald's, is already adapting their business profiles based on climate change, and not out of some desire for environmentalism, but really out of necessity, because they just simply can't afford it. So this is suddenly, you're feeling these effects everywhere. You have to remember that when an Olympian, when an athlete pushes things to new extremes, they break records. And now when the climate pushes things to new extremes, we break records. And now we break about 12,000 climate records every single month. This is a one-month map. I mean, the maps are getting so dense you can't even read them anymore, and that's what's been happening. And so far, it's kind of snuck up on us. We haven't really fully been aware of it. But now that we're aware of it, now it's just going to get, you know, uncomfortable. Now it's just going to be an awkward situation, difficult conversation, because now we know it's coming, really. And that's kind of a problem. There are these other effects too, right? Coffee, for instance. The cocoa bean can only grow so much, and they found that this deadly fungus is thriving in a hotter, wetter world, and they predict that in the next 70 years, there might not be coffee beans anymore. They might not be able to grow. So that might kind of scare you a little bit. What about sushi? You all love sushi and seafood, right? Well, it turns out that a warmer ocean is causing a decrease in cash and changing stream formations. So we predict by 2050, we'll have a 40% decrease in fish catching. What about pasta, right? You have a nice little pasta dinner. It turns out wheat production has been declining for years, and by 2050 it could be 27% less wheat production. So breads and grain wouldn't be as easy to come by. But what about wine? You can't have a nice pasta without a wine, right? Well, it turns out grapes only grow in a very specific microclimate. And in states like California, what we're seeing is already a decrease in wine production, and by 2050 there could be a 73% decrease in wine grapes. Oh, I probably have your attention now, right? But if maybe you think, well, I need to stop drinking anyway, I have a drinking problem. What about beer, good old-fashioned beer, right? It turns out that hops production has been declining every year since 1950, and by 2050, there could be no more beer. Suddenly you're paying attention, right? But what about just chocolate? My God, the chocolate. It turns out that the little fragile chocolate bean, right, just a 1 degree increase in global temperature is enough to disrupt that ecosystem. They predict by 2050 there might not be any more chocolate. If nothing else, if you get nothing else out of this conversation, please, let's save the planet for the chocolate. Please, I beg you. That's really all, you know, it's all we have left to live for at this point. So perhaps the worst effect I've seen of climate change, the absolute worst, has been seeing my sister-in-law in shorts, really. That's been a terrible side effect. Or seeing my father-in-law in bike pants, that's also been kind of awful. Or just seeing this anywhere on the streets of San Francisco with the ugly naked people everywhere. This is a real thing in San Francisco. We have a lot of nudes there. It's kind of strange. And, you know, come for the sourdough bread, stay for the ugly naked people. Okay. Let's see. Last year, astronomers discovered a new planet capable of supporting human life. And they've since discovered three more, thanks to the Hubble telescope. And this is how Brian Williams reported on it that night on the news.
Astronomers are calling their discovery a Goldilocks planet. Not too cold, not too hot, possibly just right to sustain water and perhaps life. And it's just nice to know that if we screw this place up badly enough, there is someplace we can all go.
Is that the plan? Has that been the plan just to really just find a whole other planet? Really? Because that seems crazy. Speaking of astronomers, Neil deGrasse Tyson said, you know, aliens will be shocked to learn in a universe filled with unlimited starlight that human beings are killing themselves for some energy buried in the ground. It doesn't make any sense. Yet that's what we've been doing. But imagine if aliens did come here to this planet, and they did attack us. And in attacking us, they poisoned our rivers, and they started to decimate most of the species. They started to blow up our mountains to extract energy from them and toxify the soil in the process. They cut down all of our forests, which made the planet a lot hotter, and also then started boiling the oceans, which melted the polar ice caps. And even just to be jerks, they started sneaking genetically modified organisms into our food. How would we react? What would we do as a species if they were to do this? Would we summon the might of our military and rise up and attack them? Or would we give them personhood and give them tax breaks? Like, what? I don't really know at this point. Because they don't have to do this, because we've done it to ourselves. Aliens don't need to come here. In fact, they could just wait a few more years and come into an empty planet at this rate. They're probably just sitting on the moon laughing. Really, that's what I would do. By the way, this is one of my favorite movies. This is a Charlie Sheen movie called The Arrival, which is a must-see because obviously he's clearly such a great actor. Okay. The Onion, which is a satirical newspaper last year, put out this story that Obama was trying to destroy an asteroid headed for the Earth. And because Obama was for it, the Republicans were against it. And it was satire. It was a joke. But people started spreading it around on Facebook like it was real news, because it was believable. The idea that Republicans would let the Earth blow up just because Obama was in favor of saving it. And why not? Because we are more divided than ever. We now have climate deniers in elected office in nearly every state. By the way, thank you, Oregon and Nevada, for being sane. But even in California, they have climate deniers in office, and it's crazy. And I talked to these comet deniers. I've met with a lot of them. And these comet deniers are the same people that refuse to believe that Elton John was gay in the 1970s, right? They just don't want to see the evidence for themselves. They're just a little off, these guys. And some of them are really nuts. And they follow this process that Sigmund Freud used to call kettle logic. And Freud talked about how he lent a tea kettle to a neighbor. And the neighbor brought it back broken. And he said, hey, man, what'd you do to my tea kettle? And the neighbor, first thing the neighbor said was, when I brought it back, it wasn't broken. It was undamaged. And the second thing he said was, it was already broken. He gave it to me. And the third thing he said is, well, I never bought it in the first place. And each statement is a lie, and each statement contradicts the previous one. And Freud called it kettle logic. And now that's what climate deniers are doing. They do the same thing. They go, there's no such thing as climate change. And they go, well, any climate change there is not man-made. And then, well, any man-made climate change, well, you can just fix with this thing called clean coal. And each statement's a lie, and each statement just contradicts the previous one. And that's what we've been doing. And this is what drives environmentalists nuts. This is why the little vein starts throbbing in the back of their head.
If you're a Republican above the Mason-Dixon line, it is no longer going to be possible for you to stop making jokes about climate change.
And that's what they're doing. They're making jokes because some of the things they're saying are so stupid, they can't possibly be real, right? Like this. This is Paul Brown. He's a representative from Georgia. He's the one that said, oh, evolution, climate change, big bang, they're all lies straight from the pit of hell. And that's fine to think it. In fact, it's even fine to say it on a microphone in front of TV cameras. But the trouble is that Paul Brown serves on the House Science Committee. And maybe he's not, maybe that's the wrong committee. That's all I'm saying, right? Or then we have this guy. This is Joe Barton from Texas. Joe, by the way, used to work for BP. And now he's on the House Energy Committee. They had asked Joe about wind power. They said, Joe, what do you think about wind power as a solution? And he said, oh, wind power? Yeah, wind power is no good because wind power slows down the wind. He said that on the air in front of people. That's nuts. That's crazy. And everybody just kind of looked around, and this was their reaction.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
Yeah, that's right. Last June, President Obama gave a speech on climate change, and it was important because it was the first time the sitting president gave a speech solely about climate change. Every president in modern history, going back to Lyndon Johnson, have mentioned climate change in the speech, but this sole purpose of the speech was to talk about it. And in it, it was a hot day in June in Georgetown, and he was sweating like a Baptist preacher the whole time. In fact, he was sweating so much, it got a little crazy, and in it he said that we need to act. But it kind of reminded me of this from Airplane. You remember this? It was kind of ridiculous how much he was sweating talking about climate change. But he said, you know, we subsidized the oil companies for a century. I think they're doing pretty good. I think that's long enough. And then all hell broke loose. The climate denial machine really kicked into high gear, which is why for the last year you've seen so many conflicting, quote-unquote, news stories about it.
As climate change continues to create more frequent and devastating storms, we propose a new naming system, one that names extreme storms after policymakers who deny climate change. We propose something like this.
Senator Marco Rubio is expected to pound the eastern seaboard sometime early tonight. Windows are being boarded up and grocery stores are virtually empty as Marco Rubio threatens everything in his path.
Now, Michelle Bachmann is on the way, folks, and specifically the eye of Michelle Bachmann will be hitting Florida in a few hours.
Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann is incredibly dangerous. If you value your life, please seek shelter from Michelle Bachmann.
All right, you get the idea. It goes on and on from there. Okay. What we need to do is we need to go on a diet, frankly. And what I'm talking about is a carbon diet. We all need to go on a big carbon diet. But like anybody going on a diet, they really don't want to hear the truth, right? Because you've had friends that have gone on diets, probably, and you might have even tried to be helpful and say to them, hey, have you tried just eating right and exercising? And they go, no, don't be ridiculous. Instead, I'm going to take this little pill that causes anal leakage. That's a better idea, right? That's got to be better. And when that doesn't work, you say, okay, how about now? Would you try eating right and exercising? And they go, no, instead I'm going to drink lemon juice and cayenne pepper for 3 weeks. I think that'll clean me out. That's better. That sounds good, right? When that doesn't work, okay, now maybe you'll try eating right and exercising. And they go, no, instead I'm going to have this invasive, painful procedure to put a band around my stomach. And it's crazy. And that's what we do with climate change. And none of it works. I mean, we just keep getting fatter, really, on carbon, because we ask the question, okay, now have you tried just cutting your emissions and stopping the use of fossil fuels? And instead the answer is, no, instead I'm going to spend millions of dollars on this thing called clean coal that doesn't really exist. And that's kind of the problem. If you were an astronomer and you thought that the sun went around the Earth, you'd probably do some pretty bad astronomy, wouldn't you? Which, by the way, doesn't. It doesn't. The sun doesn't go around. The Earth goes around the sun. It's the other way around. But if you thought that, you'd do some pretty bad astronomy. And that's what we have with architects. If you're an architect and you don't believe in climate change and don't believe the buildings are part of this solution to fix it, you'd probably do some pretty bad buildings. And that's what we've been doing. We've been doing really bad buildings. It turns out all the while we've been essentially building this kind of dead, lifeless skeleton. When we should have been building this, the whole creature, the living thing, the thing that adapts in response to its environment. And a few of us are doing this. I mean, we're playing with it, but we're getting there. We're not quite there yet, but we're getting there. And we're building living buildings. But what I do know is that this is clearly the wrong direction. This is a dead end. I mean, it's a pretty building, to be sure, and I love visiting it. But it doesn't make a lot of sense in knowing what we now know, especially a metal building in downtown Los Angeles. I mean, that seems a little silly, doesn't it? Especially when I show people buildings like this and I see how they react to them. They have a visceral reaction to them. When I take people to buildings like this, they reach out and touch them. They pet them. It's really kind of funny to see. They like rub the green roof. It's really hilarious to see. And they just feel better around them. This is clearly the direction we need to go. Now, I studied under students of Frank Lloyd Wright, and I would argue that Mr. Wright was the first green architect. And we didn't have, Bruce Wirt back then. He died in 1959. I don't know if you remember. But I would argue that everything that he was doing would be textbook environmentalist stuff now. And for those of you that don't know who Frank Lloyd Wright is, we'll read a book or something, will you? But if you don't know who Frank Lloyd Wright is, he was like the Michael Jackson of architecture. You know, just the king of it all, really. And this is one of my favorite houses that he did. This is the David Wright house. He did this for one of his sons. And this is in Phoenix, Arizona. And it's a round building. And on the first floor, this round ramp encloses this microclimate courtyard. And the whole thing is oriented to the sun. So the south side, which would get hot, is shaded by trees. And it allows the sun to kind of go around the building. And then you go up this ramp, which encloses this microclimate courtyard that has a little pool in it, and it stays cool. And then when you arrive upstairs, it's really a textbook passive solar house, right? It's only one room deep. It's just bent around this circle. And along the south side, there are lots of windows and light, but they're all small and really high up. They're clear stories. So they let in a little bit of light, but not the heat. And here's what it looks like in a model here. And you can see that it's really perfectly oriented to the sun. It really adapts. You couldn't move if you tried, really. And here it is at the entry when you walk up, and then you go through this kind of gate here that's on a central swivel, which is kind of cool. And you go around into the courtyard, and you can see the house is set back, so the courtyard is shaded, but the pool receives sunlight all day. And the pool stores up the heat from the sun, and then at night when it gets cool, it releases the heat back out through thermal mass, so it keeps everybody nice and comfortable. And you go up the ramp, and you can kind of brush your fingers along the underside of the house, and you arrive at the front door, and you can see his signature red tile there in front. And when you come in, it's really kind of a textbook Frank Lloyd Wright house, right? Very limited palette of materials, concrete block, and cypress, I think he used. And here you can see the windows on the south side are very high up, and they let in light, but not a lot of heat. And this being a Wright house, of course, it has not one but two fireplaces. And the kitchen is behind that second fireplace there. And you can see it's really just a pretty simple kitchen. Cork floors, linoleum countertops, bookmatch certified locally harvested wood. By today's standards, it would probably win a design award for greenest kitchen. But back then, this is 1958 or so, it was just kind of what he did. But Mr. Wright didn't know what we now know, right? He didn't know about formaldehyde or VOCs or drought or climate change or asthma or air quality or any of that stuff. He had the luxury of not dealing with what we had to deal with. So I often wonder what he would be doing today had he known what we now know. And yet we know what we now know, and yet we still build buildings like this, these ugly little boxes everywhere. I mean, I would burn this down if I could, but ironically, that would put out more carbon, so I'm torn. You know, I don't know what to do. And I realized that essentially most of us have been building PCs when we really should have been building Macs. That's really, I mean, let's face it, they're just better. They're integrated, and they're prettier, and they're better designed, and they're more forward-thinking. And that's really what it is. If you're still building non-green buildings, you're essentially doing the equivalent of selling incinerators in the year 1980. Incredible onslaught of this wave of technology that's about to come, and you're what I would call the worst architect in the world. And they even made a commercial about it.
Working hard. No, that's true. I need a brand new soap that works hard too. You are the worst architect in the world.
I love that. That's great. Okay. So what we need are living buildings, regenerative buildings, buildings that are tied to nature, buildings that make things better, not worse, buildings that make you well, not sick. That's what's needed. Buildings that are rooted into the ground, that draw their heat and their energy and their life from the ground. Buildings that you actually feed and nourish. Now, this is a look inside the human body, and this is going on inside your bodies right now, right? These big black things you see here, they're called leukocytes, and they're essentially fighting off infection because people are sick. Everybody around you is sick right now, and their gross, disgusting germs are attacking you all the time. So these leukocytes are basically the defenders of your body. And then those little shiny globules you see, those little twinkling reflections that you see in front of the camera, those are energy packets that are being sent out to the cells. They're called cholesterol. By the way, some of you have too much energy packets, too much cholesterol. You've got to cut down on the cholesterol. But anyway, all this is happening as your body is seemingly sitting here still, and yet your body's a whirlwind of activity. It's this incredible hub. So your body's very much this habitat, right? Right now, as you sit here, there's about 2 pounds of bacteria living on or in you, on the surface of your skin or in your gut. It's actually kind of gross, really. I've been meaning to talk to you about it. 2 pounds of bacteria just living symbiotically with you. So your body's very much this habitat. But your body's also this incredible machine, pumping, processing, filtering all day long, 7 days a week. So your body's also this incredible machine. But it turns out John Mayer was right. Your body's also a wonderland. It's this incredible wonderland. I mean, some of you more than others, but still, it's this incredible wonderland, just doing this, adapting to its environment, shifting its weight in your chair, changing its temperature just to make yourself comfortable. Every day, your body produces 50 trillion new cells to make up for the ones that have died. Every day, your body pumps 1,900 liters of liquid and then pees it out, turns it into pee, right? And every day, your body pumps in 11,000 cubic liters of air in and out of your lungs, converting the air from, you know, into oxygen and expelling carbon dioxide. It's incredible what your body does. And as I'm telling you all this, your brain is processing this at 170 miles an hour, faster than any known computer. And holding up that big head of yours is the structural system that's four times the strength of concrete and half the weight, by the way. It's incredible what it does. And your body produces energy. It powers itself at its peak. Like if you're riding a bike or something, you can produce 2,000 watts of energy. You've all seen The Matrix. You know what I'm talking about, right? And powering all this is not fossil fuels, but food, glorious food. And in your lifetime, you'll eat 50 tons of it. So every now and again, you know, eat a salad. That's all I'm saying, really. Just, you know, make it a little healthy sometimes. And as a byproduct of eating food as your energy source, all of you fart about 14 times a day. All of you. I mean, let's face it. And I know what you're thinking. It's about a balloon's worth. So imagine a big balloon just sitting over your heads, because that's what I'm doing to you right now. Okay. Our buildings respond to none of this. They ignore all of these amazing things that your body is doing. They're just dead, lifeless boxes. And then what we do is we kind of line the walls with known cancer-causing chemicals, and then we put in windows but don't make them operable so there's no fresh air, and then we shove our kids in there and expect them to learn for 8 hours a day, and it doesn't work. It's not working. Then we surround the site with more dead, lifeless materials, and then we just kind of plunk the houses down wherever, and we ignore where the sun is and where the wind is. And as a result, we make buildings that are inherently inefficient. And this is why the whole housing industry is always teetered economically, because it is not sustainable. That's why we have these crazy ups and downs. And it's almost like something bad is about to happen, and you can't quite put your finger on it.
Ha ha!
All right, you get the idea. He goes on for 20 minutes. By the way, that was the second Shelley Long reference of this presentation, so I'm very proud of that. Okay, so what we need are living buildings, regenerative buildings, buildings that fix the environment, buildings that are truly alive, that are teeming with life, the same way that your body is. And I mean real life, not this fake life. I mean actual life. We need to invite it in. Turns out nature already has a process for how to do this. This is called the Fibonacci sequence. You take two numbers, add their sum, and just keep going, and it goes on forever. And if you graph this in two dimensions, it creates what nature calls a spiral. And if you extrapolate that to three dimensions, it creates what nature calls a helix. And this blueprint is woven into the structure of creatures and plants all over the planet. They use this, and they do it without permits and without building inspectors. They just do it. They just build these incredible things. It turns out that if you look at plants very closely and you pay attention to them, it almost looks like they're alive. Because they're alive. It's a joke. They're alive. They're plants. They're living plants. And they're adapting and responding to their environment. It's incredible what they do. We are not the first creatures to build. This is the paper wasp. It builds its nest in a matter of days. And it takes wood pulp, mixes it with saliva, and makes a form of cement. And it can even change the water saliency of the cement based on the atmosphere, and just adding more or less saliva. And it does it on this cool hexagonal grid, by the way, right? This is the weaver bird. It builds its nest in a matter of hours. It harvests local grass and builds this structure, and the front door is just big enough for the head of the weaver bird, so only it can get in and out, and its predators can't. And it's done in this cool tripod shape. And it's incredible. And it just does it. And what do? We put up birdhouses everywhere. It's insulting, really. This is why they're pooping in your car, by the way. They're mad. You're essentially giving them Section 8 housing when they're doing these cool tripod things. It's insulting, really. So, you know, we're not the first creatures to build. Nature has a wealth of builders among it, and all we need to do is open our eyes to it. This is a butterfly egg. Here we have plants, just explosions of color and light and geometry. We have creatures on this planet that build structures like this, based on this Fibonacci sequence. And when they outgrow it and they're done with it, they leave it behind for someone else to move into. Beautiful forms, beautiful colors, mathematical equations put into real form. Some of them are edible. And it's just incredible. And our buildings ignore all of it. 3.8 billion years of research and development at our fingertips if we just only open our eyes to paying attention to nature. That's what's needed, our living buildings, regenerative buildings, buildings that we feed and nourish the same way that we feed and nourish ourselves, buildings that grow. And we're just scratching the surface of what that can mean. All it takes is for us to put nature in our mindset and make it a priority for us. That's what's needed. Then we look at things like this, we should realize this should be the inspiration for a skyscraper. That's what's needed. Because nature is strong. That's how nature builds. It will kick your butt every time. It is. Have you ever been in a hurricane? Nature is powerful, man. That's how nature builds. And how do humans build? Just the exact opposite way. Just shove it in there, brute force, just boom, boom, and it just doesn't work. It just takes massive amounts of energy and upkeep. And the results are just stupendously awful. You know, we look at nature as this thing that we have to cut around, that we have to, and the byproducts left over are just bad. You know, we're not doing it well. You know, if we were doing it better, that'd be one thing, but usually the results are just preposterous. You know, like how do we end up with these weird byproducts in our environment? You have to realize that no matter how many resources you have, if you use them the wrong way, they'll never be enough. We need to be smarter about how we use our resources and using them correctly to get to the goal of what we want. That's what's needed. We also need to realize that our resources, some of them have a history, and we need to pay attention to this history and value it. You've seen these developments everywhere, these housing developments, and they always give it these cutesy names, right? So when they call, you know, Cross Creek Estates, you know that basically they've decimated the creek to build whatever they're building there. And here, you know, they drove all the wild horses out of whatever they built here. And really, I'm terrified to think of what they cut down here. All right, that's stupid. Okay, so Paulo Coelho said, the world is changed by your example, not by your opinion. So stop waiting to be asked. Stop cowering in fear with your clients. Force it on them. Bring it up. Offer it to them. That's what's needed. We need to restore all the nature that we lose when we build. It is our duty, it is our responsibility that if you build something, that we're going to replenish the nature that we've taken away in the process. For every building, we do these five things. And we don't always succeed, but we at least bring it up and we try. First of all, every building should generate its own energy. Second, every building needs to grow at least a portion of its own food, and sometimes this becomes an opportunity, right? Third, every building needs to process some of its own waste. And fourth, every building needs to clean its own water.
Hey, Eric, we're getting a lot of lag. There's a couple seconds worth of lag, Eric. Sorry to interrupt. If there's any way you can maybe advance the slides ahead, that might be cool.
I don't know what to do about it.
No, no problem. Keep on going. Thanks.
Okay.
No problem. Keep on going.
And number five, if you've done the first four, you're doing this automatically, is to sequester your own carbon. So let's go through them quickly, right? Generate your own energy. Well, nowadays that's easy. But what it takes is realizing that renewable energy is not this thing that you add on, but that it's a missed opportunity. Every day that we don't use renewable energy, we're losing $9 billion a day. That's the fact, because we're spending on oil and coal. And if we start to look at it that way, that it's a missed opportunity that's costing us by the day, it might change your mindset of how you look at it. They recently retired the space shuttle, and it went on a kind of crazy tour around the U.S., and they had it rolling through the streets of L.A., I don't know if you remember. And I was reading about the booster rockets there, and it turns out that each booster rocket was 20 million horsepower. And I just thought, wow, that's just an insane amount of energy. And my second thought was, we still use horses for that? Like, we're still using horses as a measurement? That's just weird. And then it made me wonder, how much horsepower is in a house? And it turns out it's not that much. It turns out if you want to play Xbox, it's about 3 horsepower. If you want to watch TV, it's about 6 horsepower. So I just like that visual of idea of your kid wants to play a game and you've got to go out to the yard and round up 3 horses. I just think that's funny. Okay, so we need to realize that solar energy now is an opportunity. And, you know, a lot of people will say how ugly solar panels are, or even worse, how ugly wind turbines are, and they refer to it as a blight on the landscape. And then I remember that people forget, really, the wind turbines are a blight? You forget about all the oil rigs that are still there, and just we have this double standard on beauty. That oil rigs can be ugly and coal mining can be ugly and that's fine, but wind turbines have to be pretty and beautiful and smell nice all the time. It's just crazy to me. We have our priorities way out of whack, and we need to realize that we have to institute a new saying, which is that soil is more important than oil. That should be our goal, replenishing the nature that we've destroyed, which leads us to number two, growing your own food. Now, one of my favorite movies is Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and not that Johnny Depp nonsense. I mean the old one from the 1970s. And I realized that when I was a kid, it instilled in me this very concept of an edible building. And here's how it works.
No, everything you see is edible. I mean, you can eat almost everything.
Let me in, I'm starving!
Now, don't get overexcited. Don't lose your head, Augustus. We wouldn't want anyone to lose that. Yeah.
So imagine a truly edible building where you can break pieces off the walls and just start to enjoy them. And now suddenly that's becoming possible. So I was talking to a developer client and I said, oh, on the south side, we're going to grow food and we'll do it all up the entire facade of the building. And all I got was wave after wave of excuses why we can't do that. And he kept saying, you can't grow food. The homeless people will eat it. Oh, my God. Imagine that. Feeding homeless people. What would they say about you in the press? I was teasing him, you know. And finally I said, you know what? Calm down. Unless you start seeing this everywhere, it's probably not a problem. It's really not an issue. If homeless people start popping up with these signs, then we'll take the food down. But in the meantime, let them eat. What's the big harm? And besides, there's probably other crops you could grow that would make you more money anyway, right? What's the big deal? And so that's what we do, is we make a lot of jokes, really, to make it. And the reason that food is important is because food is a growing concern, not only where it comes from, but what's in it, because it turns out everything we eat is just awful. And we buy from companies that have these sweet-sounding names that kind of make you imagine farmers, but they're not. They're corporations. And it turns out that basically everything we eat are made by these 9 companies. So we're just eating the same toxic crap over and over again. So growing your own food is also an opportunity to be healthier. It's also an opportunity to make friends, too, if you like, right? And I know what you're thinking. You know, well, you can't grow a Twinkie, right? That's no good. Who wants to eat vegetables all the time? So I came up with this kind of in-between solution that kind of counteracts this idea of flavor-blasted extreme stuff that we're usually used to eating. And basically, we could just do this, right? Maybe we sprinkle some candy on the thing. Well, not a perfect idea, but think about it. Okay. Number three is processing our own waste. And it turns out that a lot of this waste is potentially valuable resources that we can use. So here's an idea. This is from students at Drexel University. This is a mat covered with bacteria. It's not antimicrobial. It's actually the opposite. It's microbial. We're deliberately inviting bacteria into the house the same way that we do into our gut. And the idea is that this bacteria eats dirt. So you'd wipe your feet on this, and it feeds the bacteria. So it's cleaning your house for you. It's a totally different idea than what we've been doing. We have other bacteria. This is from students at Stanford. And this bacteria is interesting because it eats poop. So poop goes in, and it generates current, electricity. So poop goes in, and then it goes, your poop could power your house, basically. That's what we're close to getting to, which is kind of amazing. And I can imagine what your faces are looking like right now as I'm telling you this. But it's, you know, it's a possibility. For the, you know, a little easier to digest would be something like this. This is an alternative to drywall. This is called ReWall. And it's made from recycled juice boxes. And you can see this sample here actually had probably an apple juice box as part of it. And the best part is it's the same strength as drywall, comes in the same size, 4x8, and it's cheaper, too. And the other side is, by the way, covered in paper, so you can still spackle it and all that other stuff. And so now I try to use this on all my projects. It's really incredible. You know, goes in just the same. The contractor doesn't even notice, really. Number four is we're going to clean our own water. And the reason we're going to do that is because our relationship with water is so weird. I mean, it's so off. You realize we're the only species on the planet that forces everybody just to pee in the same spot. And in doing so, it creates a lot of septic issues that other creatures don't have to deal with. It's kind of absurd if you think about it that way. So what else can we do with it? And it's not like these things are just going to be available at your local Kmart or you know, hardware store. We're just going to walk in and buy a fuel cell, right? So until this day comes, we need to do something else. So what we do is we advocate for gray water, which leads us to number five, sequestering your own carbon. And this is probably the most important, but also currently the most difficult. But there's some interesting technology of how to do that. We need to realize that we breathe in and out, and so do trees, and so do our buildings in a way. So this is an example. This is from Arup, and these are panels on the outside of the building. And if you zoom in on them, I don't know if you can see, these panels are filled with algae. And when the sunlight hits the algae, it activates them and causes photosynthesis. And the building starts absorbing carbon actively and producing oxygen. It is a photosynthetic building. I mean, literally photosynthetic. And it's designing the way nature does. It's kind of incredible. But I was thinking about this on a commercial scale. Imagine what a great thing it would be to, you know, work with a developer and design the typical condo downtown, right? And then when they advertise it, they could say, hey, now with fresh oxygen. Like it would be a feature. You know, they have gym and a Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi, and fresh oxygen. It would be a bonus that this could attract, you know, whatever. Okay, good. And then the last thing I want to talk to you about is this idea called 3D printing, which I know some of you know about, but might not all of you do. But I think 3D printing is potentially a great, valuable solution for sustainability. And for those of you who don't know, 3D printing is essentially growing something kind of bit by bit and printing out a whole three-dimensional object out of a printer and growing it the way nature does. And we now have this kind of off-the-shelf software that makes these things very easy, and we can create very complex geometries that before were not possible. And the results are really remarkable. I mean, you kind of design this thing, and then, boom, you hit a button, and this object appears in a matter of hours. And you can, you know, build it out of any number of materials, including a lot of nature-based, bio-based stuff. So far, a lot of it's been done for jewelry. My iPhone case, for instance, is 3D printed. It's small stuff. But the technology is breaking through right now as we speak, and suddenly we can do larger things. And so here's an example of a 3D printed room. This thing is about 15 feet by 15 feet by 15 feet. It's a cube. And the entire thing is printed out of really sand using a process called sintering. And so a laser beam zaps the sand and hardens it. And it's this whole object you can walk through. And it's a geometry that you couldn't do by hand. It would be impossible. But for the computer, it's just an algorithm. Here it is coming together. The printer can only do certain size pieces at a time, so they assemble it. And it lines up perfectly. And the amazing part is that whatever doesn't get laser sintered is left over and can be reused. So it is also a zero-waste building. We have other designers using other materials. Some designers are 3D printing in food. This designer is 3D printing with mushrooms. This is mycelium. and they're growing chairs, essentially, using 3D printing. It's kind of incredible. And now they have easy software for kids. Blockify is online, and it's free, and kids can print something and make something and then send it out to be printed and delivered it. Autodesk has this thing called Project Shapeshifter, which allows you to create complex parabolic forms and then print them. It's kind of incredible. In 1928, Herbert Hoover famously said that he had a vision for America. And the vision was that he saw a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage. And we still talk about it today as effective marketing. And the reason why it worked is because it was a bold vision. This was right at the point of the Great Depression. And it's, a critical time in America's history. And I wonder how, 86 years later, we would change this, how we would update this. Would it be an organic hormone-free chicken in every pot and a zero-emission plug-in vehicle for every garage? I mean, it doesn't roll off the tongue as well, really, but you get the idea. That's what's needed, is a big, bold vision. FDR did the same thing in his State of the Union speech in 1944. He proposed a second Bill of Rights, that every American would have the right to a job, a decent wage, a house, free health care, and this would be part of being an American. He wanted to raise the standard of living for Americans higher than ever before known. And then he died and nothing happened. But still, it was a great, amazing thing, right? And that's what we need, is a new vision. But I know that visions freak people out. But I also know people get freaked out all the time. They get freaked out with simple things. Some people are freaked out when they hear that we're spinning around at 700 miles an hour. Or that they hear that we're hurtling through space at 66,000 miles an hour. That freaks them out too. But it's fine. You don't be freaked out. I know that feeling that something bad's about to happen. You can't quite put your finger on it. I know that feeling, but it's fine. Everything will be fine. We're smart. We're resilient. We're ingenious, really. We're creative. And you can come up with something. It'll be fine. We've been known as innovators, and we can be innovators again. All we need to do is just prioritize nature in the priority. We have to stop hiding behind fear. We have to stop worrying about what our clients think and put forward the best buildings we can, knowing what we now know. But I also know that when you say anything to a client, their favorite word is no. You ask them, hey, what about solar panels? And they go, no. What about a green roof? Wouldn't that be cool? No. And that's all you hear. You just, anything you ask them, no. In fact, sometimes it's just,
oh, hell no.
And I know that feeling. But if you know that the client's favorite answer is no, and it's almost like a gut reaction that they do, stop asking them a question where you want the answer to be yes. Ask them a no question. So don't ask them, hey, do you want a green roof? Because they'll just go, no. Instead, say, hey, you want to keep paying for heat? And they go, no. Wait, what? Okay, you don't want to keep paying for heat? We'll put on a green roof. Hey, you want to keep paying for electricity? And they go, no. Wait, what are you doing? And you go, okay, we'll put on solar panels because you don't want to keep paying for electricity. We need to prioritize the no. We need to prioritize what we're asking for and start with benefit, not with opportunity, right? That's the difference. And I know it's silly, and I know it's childish and semantic, but it actually works. So try it. Just try it. You just want to really just blow it right back in their face. Just shove it right back in their face. Because what clients like to do is they like to BS you a little bit, right? One of the things they like to do is they go, solar panels are too expensive. Meh. So all I do is I ask them two little words. I go, oh, really? How many projects have you done with solar panels? And the answer is usually always the same. They go, well, none. I go, oh, so you really don't know what you're talking about then? Is that what you're telling me? None. I worked on hundreds. And that kind of shuts them up pretty much right away. And this makes them sad at times. I know sometimes they'll get upset about it. But you have to do what I call preemptive strike. Because what we have is we have a lot of architects that won't even offer it to their clients. They won't even ask them because they're afraid of the backlash that might ensue. And this idea that you're not even going to ask the question because you're afraid of some potential backlash that may or may not come, I call this phenomenon frontlash. It's the opposite of backlash. You're not even trying, so you're not getting anything. And it's causing us to slow down. We can't do that anymore. And just nothing happens. So let's stop that. We need to remember that we grew up with 3 R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Well, we need new 3 R's. Redesign, renew, and regenerate for every building, especially the existing ones. And if we start to think our way out of this mess, we can stop being dodo sapiens. And we can plant a vision for what victory looks like for the 21st century. That's what's needed. Okay, this concludes the AIA continuing education portion of the course. If you want to download the slides, Enoch has it here. You can email me or tweet me, whatever you want, and you can also download them directly from here, dodosapiens.com. Otherwise, I think we have time for questions. Thank you for listening. Thank you for paying attention. And I'm looking forward to hearing from you.
Absolutely, that we do. So just wanted to thank Eric for his time. Eric, I'm going to mute you because I'm getting a little bit of echo here. Okay. Eric, if you do have maybe a pair of headphones you can put on, it'll prevent the echo from happening. In the meantime, give us some feedback on what Eric shared. I mean, definitely very thought-provoking and disturbing at times. Maybe people can talk about or input in your thoughts, you know, what is our responsibility as architects in terms of sustainability? You know, what is it like in your personal area? What kind of challenges are you personally facing in this area? I mean, I know. So one thing that you said, and there's a question here about that client conversation, Eric. Tell us a little bit more. Basically, tell us more about how that goes in terms of convincing, you know, like you said, presenting it as a mandate instead of an option. I know that probably a lot of us, myself included, would probably be hesitant to mandate because it seems like the competition's tough out there, and if we won't do it, someone else will. You know, so it's a larger systemic problem. What are your thoughts on that? And I will unmute you, of course, so you can answer that here.
Unmuted. Sorry, they wouldn't let me unmute. I find I had a conversation with 15 of the 25 largest firms in the world, and I won't say which ones, but you know who they are. And I talked with their heads of sustainability, and on all of them, all 15, their heads of sustainability said to me, we're not allowed to offer sustainability to our clients unless they come in and ask for it. Right? I can't, you know, if they come in asking for an office building, I can't say, hey, do you want to make it LEED Platinum? Or do you want to make it Living Building Challenge? I'm not allowed to bring it up unless they do. That's what my boss tells me. And when I ask them why, the answer is because they're afraid of pissing off the client and making them run away. So I ask the question, has that ever happened? And they laugh and say, no. So you're afraid of something that's never happened, doesn't seem likely to happen, but yet that's what your boss is telling you to do. And this is 15 of the 25 largest firms in the world, and they're responsible for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of construction every year, millions of square feet being built of new buildings, certainly ones that could be capable of doing incredible things. So you have firms like HOK that are pushing the envelope as best they can. You know, Gensler's doing interesting things. But for the most part, you have a lot of these large firms that are afraid of their clients. And so that was a large part of why I wanted to talk about what I wanted to talk about. The idea that we're not even asking the question. You know, it'd be different if they were asking to their clients and the clients go, no, stop asking. But that's not happening. The clients come to you and want you to build the best building you can. There are certain conversations that we have automatically that aren't brought up, right? For instance, if a client ever said to you, why does the hallway need to be 48 inches wide? It's too big. And you would say, well, because the building code forces us to. And that's the end of the conversation. They never bring it up again. So the same thing of, what do we need solar panels for? Well, because electricity is expensive and it's causing a problem. You're going to spend a fortune every month powering this building. Okay. That's really the type of conversations that I have now. I try to just stop the debate. I stop trying to make it into this big thing. I also have removed myself from the equation. It's not what I want. I'm trying to build the best building I can for the client. And I think the people that you see that are the most successful at are the ones that have really, you know, have stopped going from the mindset of I want to build a net zero building for my portfolio because it looks good on my resume and switched to it doesn't make sense to build a wasteful building anymore, knowing what we now know. It doesn't make sense to knowing we put cancer-causing chemicals in a building, knowing what we now know. I mean, why even ask the question? So what we do in our projects is we've got 37 things that we do automatically on every job, right? Every building gets zero VOC paints. And this is what I advise people to do. You know, with the International Living Future Institute, we have the Living Building Challenge. You can't pick and choose which things you want to do. We call them imperatives because it's not like LEED. It's not a checklist. You can't just do the easy points. They're imperatives because they're all important. So no known cancer-causing chemicals into the building. Why would you do that. Otherwise, it's insane. And that's really that's where I've gotten to, is I've kind of maybe lost my patience and gotten grumpy in my old age. But really, I've gotten to that point where you got to force it on the clients because they expect you to do the best building you can.
All right, Jess says, right, Jess, good to see you here. Just going to pause for a sec. Okay. All right. Jess says, great point on communicating the benefit first. We must focus on the monetary benefits to clients because they're not all design and quality centric like we are. Sean says, Florida is tough, but I have found you can't ask yes or no questions for architecture. You need conversation questions. And then he has a question for you, Eric, which is, how do you keep the contractor from undermining your approach?
The contractor, even the well-intentioned contractor, can sometimes really undermine things. So, I did a house where I'd used advanced framing, meaning that instead of 16 inches on center, we did 24, which I do a lot of. And I took the savings that we got for the client, because we're using a third less wood, right, because we only have studs every 24 inches now. So I took the savings and we used it to specify FSC certified lumber, which cost more. I mean, it cost 20% more. And it was a nice conversation to have with the client. The client was on board. Well, the framing is going up, and I'm not seeing any of the little FSC Acorn logos anywhere. And I thought, well, they didn't sand them off. I mean, that would be nuts. Why would they do that? Where are they? And I asked the contractor, and this is a quote. He said, oh, you were serious about that? And so what are my options? Option is that they rip down all the framing they built and throw it away to buy FSC wood. No, that's stupid. That doesn't make any sense. The client did pay for FSC wood, so we got a credit, as a change order. And with it, we ended up getting better windows. Was I thrilled with it? No. But, to me, even though it was all over in the drawings, I think it was in six different clear places in the drawings, we didn't communicate it enough to the contractor, I guess, who had never done a green project before. You have these little victories and these little defeats, and, there are times when you want to bash your head into the wall. But, I've also had contractors say to me, hey, good news, we had these leftover, we had this leftover adhesive, so we didn't buy new stuff. Yeah, but the new stuff is, like, high VOC, really nasty. So they're trying. What we started doing is at the beginning we've been doing this thing called integrated project delivery, especially on the net zero projects where there's a clear goal. So what we do is we get everybody in the room before construction and explain the goals of the project. And usually whoever's not at the meeting is the person who derails the project. So, for example, let's say you forget to invite the audiovisual guy or the alarm guy, and he's not at that meeting, or she. They're usually the ones that have some box that's sucking energy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, hidden in the closet, and you can't understand why your energy goals aren't coming up, and then you got to hunt this thing down and find it. Through integrated project delivery, we've been much more inclusive, including everybody, and talking about these long-term goals. And with a net zero project, for instance, it's great because you can say our goal is to produce more energy than we consume. So therefore, here are our priorities. Lower the base load of energy in the first place. Look at the energy efficiency of all the devices, including something simple like a cable box or a TiVo. And what you get is some of the best ideas come from people that, on the project team that have never even worked on a project before. So we're leveraging their expertise. So I'm a big fan of what we call IPD, integrated project delivery.
All right. Eric, we have some requests here about your checklist of 37 items. Can you give us access to that so we can share it with the participants?
Sure. Oh, yeah, it's actually on the Organic Architect website, and it probably hasn't been updated in a few years, but it's under downloads, and it's free, and you can download it for free. And it's just called No-Brainers if you want to look for it or search for it. And for each of the no-brainers, it kind of gives a little explanation. And over the years, I've added to it and changed it a bit. But some of them are kind of obvious. zero VOC paints, zero VOC caulking and adhesives. A lot of the, a lot of the kind of glue stuff that you forget about always sneaks in. So that was something that I specify right away, and I've got a list of companies for you there, so it'll help you if you've never specced it before. My nose is so big and sensitive now that if I walk into a job site, I usually can smell right away if something nasty has been brought on the site. Because I get hives and react from it. I don't know if that's psychosomatic or like I'm actually, environmentally sensitive now, but it drives me nuts. Go to organicarchitect.com and you can download the list. And also, I would go to living-future.org and you can look at our red list and our materials information, and there's some incredible stuff there too.
All right, Eric. Well, thank you very much. I know it's a definitely pressing problem that we all need to be thinking about, and so that's why I was happy to see you on the summit list here, because we wouldn't be whole unless we address the sustainable side of things. So just another note from Charlotte from the UK here. She says, inspiring and amusing, our practice in the UK also provides sustainability assessments and work for larger engineers and architects, and yet both disciplines think low carbon and sustainable design is the other's issues, and worse, see it as a tick box issue. This is perhaps why they don't speak to their clients. Legislation is going to have to drive the same issues in the UK. And she makes the question, do you think it's the same for other countries?
Other countries have differing cultures. Any work that I've done with the UK, they have, instead of LEED, they also have LEED there too, but they have BREEAM. And it's interesting, the European Union countries especially are much more regulation focused, which has its benefits, but it also has its drawbacks. Our European partners always say that America is so much better at marketing sustainability. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's something, it's their perception of it. And I also just think it's, we just need to have different conversations. We generally never talk about post-occupancy. We never talk about operational costs. We never talk about selling that as a benefit. It's always more we're asking permission. Hey, is it okay if we have a green roof? Instead of just kind of putting the green roof on and then explaining why as part of a design solution. We're so used to doing that. I don't know. It's kind of weird that we don't do it with sustainability. So, for instance, I see architects and engineers and designers all the time saying, we made this wall thicker because we had plumbing in it. Okay. We added this overhang because it would control daylighting. We added this clear story. I think we could just expand the conversations we're already having to include operations, and suddenly you could be seen as a real asset to your clients. That's why I explained to them, listen, we can cut your operational costs in half. Now, granted, if they're a developer and they're looking to sell the building or lease it as quickly as possible and they're not paying me the electricity bill every month, they probably don't care. But then instead we talk about different things. We talk about either selling that as a benefit to tenants, to attract tenants, or monetizing it away. So one of the things that I've been playing with is having developers essentially subsidize solar and then sell the power to their, to their buyers. So, they see it as an amenity, but it creates a residual income. So they put solar on the building, they own the solar, they sign it over to the HOA or whatever entity is running it, but they're essentially in the utility business now. And there are certain states that allow this and certain states that don't. But I'm trying to change the financial model for developers, because that's really what needs to happen. But for anyone who's occupying the building, their operation costs are a huge thing that they never talk about. So one of the things that we do is we get the capital people in the same room as the operations people. So the people that were paying for the building to be built, we're having them talk to the day-to-day operations people who actually have to pay the utility bills. And they usually have never met, which is kind of funny. They know each other's name from a call sheet, but they've actually probably never been in the same room. They might not even be in the same office. So we put them in the same room in a meeting. And when the capital people start to hear, we're spending how much on electricity every month? Suddenly they're much more interested in these ideas of saving money. And so that's another little kind of trick that works.
All right, Eric, thank you very much for joining us today at the Business of Architecture Summit. Really appreciate it. And Donna says, just a note here, a quick look at your website shows a wealth of info in your tip sheet. Thank you for sharing this info, and I look forward to reviewing it. So thank you for joining us. This info.
Ring. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you guys so much. Feel free to go to organicarchitect.com. We have a bunch of things there. And living-future.org, and we have a lot of things there. So enjoy. And please feel free to email me. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.